Hello, hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the 343 Podcast, where we work tirelessly to elevate the level of discourse, and this country needs that, and level of practitionership. This country also needs that in American soccer. Today's episode deals with a question, a topic that I probably get the most emails and questions about over the past 10, 15 years, and that is, hey, Gary, my teams are dominating. They have 60, 70% possession throughout an entire game, but we just can't score, you know, and maybe the other team gets a break and scores or gets a set piece and scores, or it ends up being a tight game, or we might lose 1-0. And granted, many of these teams, many of these coaches end up having a great winning percentage at the end of the season, but they do have this difficulty in the final third. And it is a very common theme, not just for them, but for us and everybody at the pro level. I mean, it is the million-dollar question. It's, hey, how do we improve in the final third? So Benny brought that up today. At per usual, I don't have anything scripted. I don't even know the topics beforehand. So it's basically a free-flowing, authentic conversation. But I think that we did capture a lot of the main ideas, the helpful ideas, and at times a reality check when it comes to how to improve your team in that final third. So I hope you enjoy. But first, I need to remind, especially the ones who are new to the 343 Podcast, that nobody sponsors this episode. Nobody sponsors this podcast in general. We sponsor ourselves. We finance it ourselves. And the way that we do that is we offer our own products and services for coaches and for parents. What we've done is we've codified the pioneering work of Brian Kliban, who revolutionized or helped revolutionize the youth development methodology and mechanisms and environment here in the United States. And you can see his art and his coaching and his methodology at 343coaching.com. Coaches, there are free and premium programs for you there. If you've listened to us for a very long time, at this point, you should be pretty well familiar with what all the accomplishments have been around here, and you should be diving straight into eyes wide open with all of this and catapulting your careers. So as the answer goes with the question, when should I join? Well, yesterday would have been best, but today is just as good, and tomorrow not so much. So head on over to 343coaching.com and get your asses in there. Parents, we've also codified our decades worth of experience from U9 to U19 and our decades worth of experience at the professional level. So we've seen the entire pipeline, cradle to grave, cycle after cycle after cycle. So with all that, we've codified the knowledge for you, parents, so you can sidestep years and years of trial and error and get the meat and potatoes up front in order to help mentor your kids way better. For you, you can go to 343masterclass.com. Last but certainly not least, if you're coaching the little ones in the 7-versus-7 format, coaches, go to 7v7coaching.com. With that, here we go. How do we solve the final third conundrum? Enjoy.
I spent the morning, you know, thinking about what we could talk about and came up with something good, I think, something that a lot of people want to hear. The magic question, Gary.
Have at it.
The magic question, how do you get your team to score more goals? You know, so there's a whole module in the 343 coaching education platform on attacking. So I thought we could go through, you know, some of those and just some, you know, kind of generic questions that I have for you. And I think a lot of people will have as well. But to start, Gary, the first lesson within that module is, I think, something that gets overlooked. And, you know, maybe most coaches wouldn't even think to practice this or rehearse this, but this is in regards to losing your man. So what is the importance of losing your man, and how do you train it? How early can you start training that? And I think for some coaches, especially if you're new to the game, maybe it's a concept that, you know, you've never even heard of. Obviously you've heard maybe like, oh, get open or get into space, but I think losing your man is such a complex topic. And it doesn't get discussed a lot, especially in the American mainstream media. So what is the importance of it? And how did Brian and how did you like come up with this? Or obviously you guys didn't come up with the concept, but when did you realize it was so important? And that, you know, you felt that you needed to add it into this attacking module.
Benny, it's quite interesting what you mentioned there. The traditional view historically has been like, oh, get open, right? Or find space or things of that nature. Because that when I was growing up, that's what my coaches were yelling at me, you know, and our teammates the whole time. And yeah, so losing your man obviously has more of a deliberate thing to it. So literally you're saying, hey, you probably got a man close to you, lose him. And then obviously get open. So it's analogous to getting open and analogous to finding space. But the caveat there is deceiving the defender or deceiving whoever is closest to you. So if somebody's, I don't know, within 5 yards of you, that's already very close, particularly at the lower skilled levels, because the lower skilled you are, the more space you actually need to actually control the ball and take the time to maybe turn and pivot and make a decision. So And at the highest of levels, it's even more critical. I take that back because the space is even tighter. I mean, it's, you know what? I don't even know. I don't know where it's the most important. I just know it is critically important across all ages and levels. So basically, we came up with an exercise, or Brian rather came up with an exercise. I actually don't know where he got this particular one from. There's several variations, of course, because, well, we can talk about them. And importantly, this is... Not importantly. I think it's most important for the midfielders and maybe for the attackers, because that is where things are more compact and more dense, and you're surrounded by players, the opponent players. Because if you're playing in the back line, the back four, maybe even the defensive midfielder, you know, you might get pressed by two players, three maximum, maybe one, maybe they don't press you at all. And you're always facing forward for the most part, so you don't have to lose your man. But if you're in an 8, a 10, or a winger, you've got somebody next to you. So what you want to do is maybe fake like you're going to run in behind, and then they bite it, and then you turn and go back and check to the ball, for instance. So that little movement right there already creates a significant amount of space between you and the defender, especially if they don't follow you. Because it's a lot of work as a defender, especially at the youth levels. You're like, oh, what's this guy? Am I really going to follow, you know, him all around, and he's doing all these jukes? Am I really going to bite into all of these sorts of things? They usually don't. And so that's one variation. The other variation is maybe like checking to the ball, or faking like you're going to check to the ball with one or two steps, or a shoulder sort of dropping of the shoulder, and then having the defender bite. And then you run in behind. And then obviously your teammate has to be keyed into these movements so that they can feed you appropriately. So the exercise kind of works on both of those things. It works on the actual guy losing their man off the ball, and your teammate in possession looking for those cues and making the appropriate decision of making the proper delivery, right? Let's make sure that your teammate isn't also biting into the fake. So I since you want to talk about finishing and scoring goals, this is a key element for you to obviously eventually get into the final third in some sort of controlled fashion, as opposed to some sort of random fashion.
Yeah. You bring up a good point, Gary, about at the lowest of levels, like this concept is huge, because if you have a shocking first touch, Gary, like every second on the ball matters, every yard of space matters. So this is a massive concept that, you know, you need to instill within your players. And then even, you know, on the other end of the spectrum, looking at the professional game, like as soon as you get the ball, you have maybe 2-3 guys immediately pressing on you. So any inch of space is going to help you out. I think a really big thing, though, Gary, is if you don't rehearse this in training, like what I see a lot of mistakes that I see at the younger ages is, for example, let's say a player is trying to lose his man, and that initial run that he makes to like fake the defender, the person on the ball thinks that that's actually the run that he's trying to make. So he'll ping it in, and then everybody gets pissed at each other. Like, what are you doing? So I think if you don't rehearse it and choreograph it with your teams, or make them have little cues, that's where the confusion can happen. So it's very important within your session to say, hey, like if Jose is making this run in behind, it's because he wants to drag the defender away, you know, so they all have to be on the same page. I think that's huge.
It critically important to train your players and train your team. That's why we teach actually training real stuff and real world things, because it seems like inexperienced coaches, and even worse, the fan base at large, they may not really have a firm grasp on the notion that you have to train these things. You can't just talk about them. You can't just say, hey, Mikey, lose your man, you know? And what I mean by lose your man, Mikey, is just like fake like you're going this way and then go the other way. And then think that that is enough for Mikey to then go and execute the actual thing. I think there's this broad misconception, generally speaking, amongst the American soccer fan base and the general coaching base as well, if I'm being frank. So that's critically important. And yes, I thought about it a little bit more. And I think the earlier the age, the even more effectiveness this has for the reason you just cited. And obviously, it's critically important at the professional level, at the highest of levels in the world. And you can see it. I challenge the audience. I think, you know, if you're a coach, if you're a parent in particular who wants to help their kid out, when you're watching professional games, stop ball watching, take a look at off the ball, what's happening with the team in possession, and you will find almost all over the field in every possession, players constantly trying to juke their defender and losing their man. All the time it's occurring. So going back to how important it is at the pro level, that it might be a little bit less important than maybe at the 10-year-olds or the 12-year-olds or the 14-year-olds, is the pros also have another tool in their tool belt when it comes to pressure and being successful. Aside from having very, very good technique already, they've already thought of their decision if the ball comes to them. So even if they're under pressure, when the ball comes to them and a guy's draped all over them or he's surrounded by two or three guys, no space, no time whatsoever, he's already made his passing decision or his dribbling decision. So it's like a one-touch, bing, bing, and out of pressure. End of story. So you may not have had to lose your man as much in that instance. And at times, at the pro level, and even, you know, Brian would even do this at the highest of levels in the youth game, when there are 17-year-olds or 18-year-olds or 16-year-olds, sometimes you want to drag your defender with you and you don't want to lose them. You want the defender to be on your back the entire time because then that creates space for somebody else. You feel me? So you actually don't want to lose your man. There's a second order thing that's being worked on.
Yeah, no, that kind of reminds me, Gary, of when Pep had Messi as kind of like a false nine, and he would kind of just post up on the center back, drag him in. He would want the center back to come with him, and then the winger would just slip in behind. And brilliant, brilliant game. There's a clip on YouTube. It's like when false nine Messi like changed the world or something. Badass game though. But yeah, you're 100% correct, Gary. And actually, it's funny that you brought that up about not ball watching, because I learned that from you. I don't know, years ago, you told me like, hey, don't just watch the ball when you're watching high level soccer. And then it's funny because maybe 3 weeks ago, I went to a Open Cup game for LAFC just because the ticket was $10. And
you paid $10, bro. Okay, go ahead.
Well, dude, I'm a fan of the game, you know. So you know, right. There's a game, I'm gonna go see it. But no, dude, I mean, I was sitting, obviously my ticket was $10, so I was like sitting as high as possible. But just watching the entire picture, it's fascinating because, like you said, so many people are just focused on the ball. Like their eyes are literally glued to the ball. And if you're not doing that, if you're looking at the movement off the ball from the other players, you're like, holy shit. Like every single time the winger gets the ball, the 10 is like checking out into a different space and losing his guy. And a lot of people don't see that. So I think that's a critical factor, Gary.
Yeah, for sure. But Jesus Christ, LAFC, MLS, bro. Like, if you want to really learn this stuff, you look outside. No. I know, bro. I just have to throw in my little jabs here and there, obviously.
For sure. Yeah, you said you've never paid for an MLS game in your life.
Never in my life have I paid for an MLS match. And I've been to, I mean, more than I can count. See, folks, the folks who don't know, man, they're like, oh, Gary, you're just a hater, or not just a hater, because they don't even know who I am. They're like, oh, you're just complaining. You don't even watch MLS. You don't know anything. You're a Euro snob. All you do is watch European soccer or whatever. I have watched and studied more MLS than people who actually cover it for a living. Okay. I've been doing this since 1996, the first fucking year, Benny.
What's your take, Gary? Do you think, obviously, you've seen since the creation of the league, do you think the quality of level has improved? I mean, nowadays, I feel like 10 years ago, like you guys even posted the video, like extreme jungle ball version. And like, that's how every MLS game was, like back and forth in the air. The ball never touched the ground. Now you see, you know, a lot of teams trying to build out of the back, trying to play. Do you think the quality has gotten better and is it changing?
Marginally. So what comes to mind, Ben, I mean, I think it has gotten better, but not like at the pace. So if you look at improvement on a curve, the rest of the world has also gotten better. Okay. And so it just naturally, you're going to get better because there's more information out there. There's more infrastructure. There's just everything naturally improves. Things don't degrade over time. So yes, but it's not some sort of massive credit to the things that people think about, right? Oh, the players are better and, you know, the coaching is better and all of these things are better. Not so much, maybe marginally. Because one of the things that comes to mind is, you remember the LA Galaxy when they had Keane and when they had David Beckham and when they had Landon Donovan on the same team and they had that whole group? I think that team, for instance, would destroy a ton of the teams in the league that currently exist. So, and obviously that was one of the better teams back then, but I think you can make the same argument across the board. Teams from 10, 15 years ago could absolutely compete and win the teams that exist today without much of an issue. So I don't think the improvement is what it's made out to be. I think there's a lot better marketing. And because of the marketing, there's this perception that things have gotten better.
But are teams trying to play possession soccer now, Gary?
I think a little bit more so. I think a little bit more so. And I've said this a million times. Brian brought it to the youth level because historically everybody said it's impossible to do it at the youth level. Gary, you don't know what you're talking about. Brian, you don't know what you're talking about. These are American kids. They don't play soccer every day, all day, like the Argentinians, Brazilians, French, Italians, Belgians. You can't have kids play possession soccer and play real soccer. And Brian proved them all wrong. So that, you know, that's why we exploded onto the scene. Caleb Porter proved everybody wrong at the college level because he got, you know, everybody was saying, Gary, Brian, it's cool that you did this at the youth level, but college is different. You can't do it in college. It's much more physical. You know, there's all these substitution rules that ruin everything. And Caleb Porter came along with Akron and for years on end proved everybody wrong. I mean, Caleb Porter's teams looked like Pep Guardiola's Barcelona. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but you get what I'm saying at college. And then the idea was like, oh yeah, well, that's just college. MLS is different. These are pros now. You don't have the space and time that you have in college. You can't do it. And then Tata Martino came to Atlanta United and proved all of that narrative being a big pile of bullshit also. So I'm giving you the historical context all to kind of culminate into, yes, MLS all of a sudden got transformed in many respects with them now trying to build out of the back and actually play real soccer versus just some randomness. So they're trying. I think a lot depends on obviously the player personnel and who is in charge. Who is in charge of not only on the coaching front, but who is in the front office also, the management, because sometimes management is such imbeciles that they will buy and sell players that don't fit what is required. And that ruins everything. And sometimes the front office has more power than the manager, the head coach, and the front office has a massive influence on who gets to play, who doesn't get to play. Like there's all this back room garbage going on, and that ruins everything. Because to play top level football and play it quote unquote properly, you need all ships to be aligned and everybody pulling in the same direction.
Right. All right. Last question on this MLS stuff, because I know we're supposed to be talking about how to get your team to score more goals, but how much say does a coach have in like who he wants to sign to his teams? Like if the coach goes and says, yeah, so
it depends, Ben.
Yeah. What you're saying is like if the front office is not aligned with the coach, then that's when like the GM is bringing in players and the owners are like, oh, let's sign this kid for publicity and things like that.
There's all kinds of reasons, but yes, if the coach is not powerful, first and foremost, I think the coach needs to be a powerful coach that has the political power to kind of dictate and be in charge. That's important. It's not necessary, but it's important. And if it's not politically, if they're not super powerful like that, like say an international caliber, big name guy, then you need alignment and you need people in the front office who actually know what the fuck they're doing also. And to, more to your point, there's all kinds of political things going on, Benny. It could range from nepotism to playing favorites of, oh, well, you know, the president's agent, literally, you know, an agent can be representing the president of the franchise or the general manager of the franchise. And then his players, his clients get stuffed into the roster, which may not be a good fit at all. So many factors, Benny. I can't even tell you. And then here in MLS, it's even worse because MLS, the central authority, the league, throws monkey wrenches left, right, up, down, every which way in order to maybe tilt the scales so that a certain franchise has certain advantages and that disadvantages another franchise.
Right. Gary, that's why you see Greg Vanney's son starting at the 10 every game for Los Dos.
Is that true? I haven't even followed. I have no idea. I know Chris Klein's kid was on the second team too.
So, yeah.
Man, there's so many things I could say. I'm just going to be quiet.
Yeah, probably for the best, dude.
For today, I may not be quiet forever.
Right. So Gary, you hear all the time from coaches, especially when they're trying to play in a possession-based system, like, oh, we bossed the game, 80% possession, we dominated, and they end up scoring, you know, zero goals. How big of a role do attacking patterns play, you know, in helping your team finish, but also just to have that choreographed movement that, you know, it's not easy to do. And a lot of people, or I guess you could say some of the haters would say, like, oh, you know, you're rehearsing plays within soccer, but, you know, soccer's a fluid sport. It's not going to be the same situation every single time. So obviously within the course, there's, I don't know, six or seven different variations of attacking patterns that you see Brian grow through with his teams. I think people have the misconception of like, oh, like you're going to call out play number two and this is exactly what you're going to do. But that's just obviously that's not what happens, you know. So how, first of all, how do you train attacking patterns with your team, you know, and why is it so important to do that?
Yeah. So the attacking patterns, in particular, the ones that we have historically been teaching are just patterns that happen over and over and over and over again in football. And it's part of the nature of the game. So for example, it's a natural organic thing that you want numerical superiority when you're attacking, because that gives you an advantage, a higher probability of being launching a successful attack. So how do you create a numerical superiority is maybe you have your outside back join the attack. And then the question is, well, how do they join the attack? And one such option that everybody, I'm sure, in the audience is very well aware of, which is the one I'm picking here, is the overlap run. So maybe the center mid gives a pass on the ground to the winger. And when that action is going to happen, that whole posture triggers the outside back to recognize, oh, here we go. He's going to give it to the winger. I'm going to dart up the sideline and overlap my winger. And in the process of doing that, I may potentially be creating a 2-versus-1 situation with the opponent's outside back in that instance. And that launches a successful attack. So that right there is an attacking pattern. Maybe the central mid dishes to the winger, triggering an overlapping run by the outside back. And then the winger chooses either to give the pass to the overlapping outside back, or if his defender follows the overlapping outside back, the winger chooses, oh, now I have space to dribble into the heart of their final third, or shoot or do something else, right? So that's an example of an attacking pattern. And again, I repeat, the reason something like that is taught and rehearsed over and over and over again with your players and your teams is not to call out plays like in American football. It's these are natural things that happen fundamentally in the game. And so by training them over and over and over again, this and along with 3 or 4 or 5 other things, the players themselves eventually see the game, right? They see what's happening and they themselves realize what's going on and decide, oh, we're going to execute this thing that's developing organically right now. Will that lead you to score goals? Not, I mean, yes, it helps you. It helps up the probability. But then I'm sure we're going to talk about this. Something else has to happen too.
Yeah, 100%, Gary. Is rehearsing attacking patterns, because obviously, you know, within an hour session, or let's say you're focusing on attacking patterns for, let's say, 45 minutes. Is that enough reps for your wingers to work on their services, the strikers to work on finishing? Or would you recommend that the nines and the wingers spend time outside of training on their own, rehearsing and, you know, finishing reps, hitting it from outside the box, inside of the foot curlers? Like, should they be spending time on their own outside of training?
So obviously I'm going to say yes, but one distinction here is that the attacking patterns are different than what you just described. So what you just described is kind of the end product of maybe what happened through an attacking pattern. So for instance, a winger serving across, right, or a winger taking a shot on goal, or the central forward crashing the goal and finishing a playoff as well, you know, and actually getting the shot on target. So there's the pattern, which is tactical recognition and understanding the principles of the game. And then there's the finished product to actually score. So with that second piece, you're absolutely right. While we'll do it in training, while I recommend coaches do it in training and try to implement as much repetitions as possible, in the team training environment, you will never get enough repetitions to get to the higher levels and to get really good. I mean, you'll improve, but you won't make a significant jump in capability. So especially for strikers and wingers, you know, especially for serving balls and then for finishing off plays with different looks. For that, you need thousands of repetitions, and you will never get thousands of repetitions in the team training environment. You have to do it by yourself.
Right. For the nines in particular, Gary, within that, you know, individualized training outside of the training environment, you know, I often see, like, whenever you roll up to like a park or something, or like a school where you see somebody like let's say they're a nine and they're finishing, they literally just have a pile of like 12 balls outside the box and they're just basically hitting free kicks, you know, and to me, that's not game realistic. It's not going to help them have that hunger for goals. Would you recommend like going out with somebody and working on like combination play, like even if it's just two guys, you know, a little wall pass to finish or movement off the ball slipped in behind? Because obviously there's some benefit to training on your own and rehearsing those reps, but do you think you get more out of it if you're training with somebody else and having more game realistic moments like that?
Yeah, so I kind of look at it as different phases or different steps, and maybe this is something that we can incorporate into the masterclass as well and make it very clear. So step one is what you described. You got a bag of balls, you're at a park by yourself, you maybe kind of like line them up, you know, at the 18-yard line or something like that, and you're hitting shots on target. That's step one. It's better than nothing. So absolutely go out and have your kids go out and do that. And what you can garner from that step one is the development of your technique, right? So you're building muscle memory, you're learning what works and what doesn't work in striking the ball. Maybe you can work on placement, you know, and having more control over your strikes and different types of strikes. So that's kind of like the analogous to team training where there's no pressure on you. Yes, you have no pressure, but you still get something out of it. Step two is you're still by yourself, but you incorporate movement into your finishing. So you don't have a line of balls and that are static and then you're firing on goal. No, you actually incorporate some jogging or running with the ball and then you hit a strike on target. And you do that thousands of times and that takes you to step two. Step three is maybe doing step two, but making sure that you're getting really tired, Benny, if that makes sense. So let's say you have like 10 balls or 12 balls or something. You line them up, I don't know, 30 yards away from goal. And then you do the movement in step two, you dribble and take a shot. And then you sprint back to get the next ball. And then you do it. And then you sprint back to get the next ball. So by the time you get to the sixth ball or the seventh ball, the eighth ball, the ninth ball, the 10th ball, you're already exhausted. And so your mental acuity has degraded a lot. Now let's see how good you can finish, you know? And if you get really good at that, Then all of a sudden, when it's the 80th minute in a game or the 70th minute of a game, or you just made some sprints, you know, in a game, but an opportunity for your team pops up, you have trained to have a good mental acuity to actually be able to focus and finish the play. So that's kind of like step three, Ben. And maybe step four, I mean, and you don't have to be in sequence. You can do whatever you want, but I'm telling you the levels of it all. Step four is, yeah, maybe you have another partner with you that's serving balls into you with different looks, and you're crashing the box and you need to finish. And maybe, you know, after that, maybe you've got two partners, you know, and you could just build up a whole schema of how to work on your finishing from the most novice of levels to the most advanced of levels.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. I think, Gary, a lot, especially in the youth game, teams find success because of individual players. But then as they get older, right, obviously everybody grows, everybody, you know, becomes as fast as each other, and those kind of special individualized players kind of, you know, fall in the shadows. Let's say a team doesn't have that individual player, right? And they're rehearsing attacking patterns. They're doing it all the time in training. Their players are really good at losing their man, but they're still not finding the back of the net in every single game, you know. What would you recommend for that coach? Because you hear that all the time, right? I mean, you get emails like, Gary, like, you would be so shocked. My team was bossing the game. We're dominating possession, but we just cannot score, you know. So where do you go from there? I mean, obviously, it's a million-dollar question.
It's the million-dollar question, Benny. It's not just the youth coaches. It's the professional coaches who are also like, oh, my God, like, we've got everything, but what the Americans like to say, the final product, right, is actually punching it in the goal. And you've heard me say it a million times. I'll say it again. This is why number nines or goal scorers are the most valuable players in the world. They cost tens of millions of dollars or hundreds of millions of dollars in the case of Erling Haaland. And that is what makes the difference when the margins are so close, where everybody's really good. When you have, say, an Argentina versus a Brazil or something like that. Yeah. Well, Argentina has Messi, and Brazil, you know, I mean, Neymar is fucking world-class. Don't get me wrong. Neymar is, for me, the number two guy in the world after Messi. He was above Cristiano Ronaldo, and people will take issues with that. That's fine. We can have a whole debate if you'd like. I can give you my rationale for it. No problem. But so maybe that's not a great example, Argentina versus Brazil, but Argentina has Messi, right? And he has that capability, and most all the other teams in the world don't have that capability. So even if Argentina were to get bossed in a game, Argentina will probably win anyway, because you give it to the goat up top and during the past 15 years, and he'll just do a disaster on you and score and finish the game. Or like Barcelona. How many times have you heard Pep Guardiola say, the only reason I had success at Barcelona, the only reason I am who I am today and have all this notoriety and fame and et cetera, is because of Messi, period. And he's being sincere, period, end of story. So Benny, going to your question now, it's happened to us a million times. We bossed the game, 65% possession, 70, 75. The other team has nothing, right? But we can't score because maybe we just don't have a special player that can actually finish the play. If we had a special player or two special players, even better, that are killers, then we win 10-0 or 5-0 or 7-0. And it's happened to, I'm sure, to Brian's teams. I can't remember exact dates or who the situations where maybe Efra was gone, you know, or Uli wasn't around, you know, or the guys who would finish the plays for us. And guess what? We wouldn't score as much and the games were tighter. And you just don't, anything can happen at a particular moment in time. So you need the special player. If you don't have the special player, here comes the recommendation. You're kind of screwed. You need to tell your players, hey man, you guys need to work on finishing. Oh, go to the park, like our talk before. Go and work on your own. Go get a personal trainer. Take a million shots on goal. Can a youth coach help improve and do that for them in the team training environment? Sure, they can spend the next several months working on finishing alone, but you're going to make this much improvement, Benny, and it's not going to be significant within 3 months. to solve that problem. The other thing that I should emphasize here before I shut up is when you get to the final third, especially if you're dominating possession, this a key important point. If you dominate possession, that means you have the opponent kind of backed up all the way into their final third many a time. And so when you're attacking, there's so many bodies in the way in the final third. And so it becomes that much more difficult to actually score because there's just so much traffic. Versus if you're counterattacking a team, then there's so much space, you know, and so much more time. And the probability of you probably scoring on one of those attacks might be better, might be good. And that is why a lot of youth teams lose sometimes who dominate possession, because you're dominating, you can't punch it in. But the opposing team has one counterattack or two counterattacks, an oh crap, or a corner kick, oh crap, and they scored and you lose the game, or they drew the game on you because you had congestion in front of you and they didn't.
Yeah, I think also, Derry, what it comes down to is one, like, for example, a lot of teams do a good job of getting in behind and getting the ball to their wingers. But at the youth ages, the delivery of the service is kind of shocking, Gary. Like, I mean, their head is down. They're not even looking at who they're serving it to. You know, so the coach is like screaming at them, like, you know, why are we finishing our chances? But it's coming down to the one, the winger is giving, you know, absolutely shocking services, like straight to the other team or straight to the goalie. No idea in mind, you know. The other thing that I see a lot of teams struggle with is, let's say their nine does break in behind and, you know, maybe they get a through ball slipped. Their 1v1 finishing with goalies is, again, it's like very, very poor, you know. So I think if you're having those types of problems, it's kind of on you as a coach to like assign those specific players homework. Like, hey, you're the nine, you miss four 1v1 opportunities. Go to the park with your dad and have your dad be the goalie and take 100 reps of you going 1v1. Or if you're the winger, pick out a target, serve it to that guy every single time, you know, until you can't get it wrong. And the other thing here, I mean, you probably agree with this too. I feel like a lot of the goals when Brian had like the TFA team and at the very young ages, I mean, you'd see like Mendez shooting from like 20 or 30 yards out and the goalies are absolutely shocking at that. Not even just shocking, but like they're tiny. So like any shot in the air is basically a goal. So I think if you can train, if you have a kid on your team that can hit it from far, or if you have like that special type of 10, like encourage them, take risks outside the box. And I think a lot of goals could come like that, especially at the youth ages.
No, all great observations, man, and very practical for the audience. So thank you. I think you, one of the things that's important that you said is for coaches to be able to ID maybe what the biggest issue or issues are, like poor service, and then be able to give specific recommendations for your players to work on. I think that's a great observation, Ben.
Yeah. So Gary, I know for a lot of, or most of the attacking patterns that you see within the course, it's kind of where the center backs are already positioned like at half field. So basically your whole team is in the opponent's half. What about like when, let's say you're in the middle of the pitch, Gary, how can you train not only your tents to like recognize the spaces in behind and slip those balls, but how do you train that movement off the ball from your winger, or from your nine, or even like from the eight to go and break the line and, you know, just kind of cause chaos in the back line? How do you train those specific movements with your team? Because oftentimes, Gary, you're not like, I think a lot of goals come from plays in transition, meaning like your team just won the ball in the middle of the field. You catch the other team off guard and you slip it in behind. But if you don't have your front three making those runs or bending their runs, then you're never going to be able to get in behind. So how can you train that?
Yeah. So it's not really a pattern at that point, because that's kind of a transition situation where, yeah, example you gave, win a ball in midfield. Say your eight wins the ball in midfield and he's already facing the attacking goal. You can easily develop an exercise. Obviously, we didn't really train this all that much because in some respects, we were fortunate to have, and this is what we love, this is what we focus on, Benny, and this is our specialty, is the central midfield. That's what Brian played as a player. That's where I played as a player. Those are our favorite players, the guys with the most skill, most control, most vision. And so since in many respects, we had great central midfielders, First, it's easy to give verbal instruction to them and not necessarily have to train them in this particular instance that, hey, if you get the ball in midfield and you have space in transition, try to quickly do damage to the opponent and dish it to the wingers, for instance. But you absolutely can train it. And we actually do it, although it's not specific to that, like say in the rondos, like transition rondos. So in a transition rondo, you have basically two teams. Let's say it's a 4v4 plus three sort of thing. So you have two teams of four, you have three neutrals that always like stay in the middle or stay in certain areas. And then when one of the teams loses possession, the other team transitions into the rondo and the other team transitions outside of the rondo. And that transaction of transition, you have to think fast, right? When you first gain possession, where is my immediate outlet? So to your point, you have to train your central midfielders to always be aware of where your teammates are and where the opportunities to exploit are in case you happen to win the ball in this instant. And when they do, they already have their decision made. And the wingers have to always be ready. Hey, if we win the ball back right now, what am I going to do? So I think it's a lot of verbal speaking to the players, but the rondos themselves intrinsically train the transition moments. You can, but hey, don't get me wrong. You can develop a special exercise for that specific thing that you just said too.
Right. How much of it, Gary, is having the players together, like with the coach watching international games or high level games? I remember with that first rage team that Brian had, like during, I think it was during the 2006 World Cup or maybe 2010. I remember like every, like the round of 16 quarterfinal, like they would be watching it as a team and Brian would be dissecting it. Do you recommend that for coaches and teams as well?
No, of course, of course. Obviously, the challenge there is that coaches only have a certain amount of time and they're paid like shit. And then you're asking the coaches to do 40, 60, 80 hours a week and make soccer their life for a miserable salary and for a thankless job, because nobody's really going to thank you for these sorts of things. They, you know, parents and people start expecting that, oh, this is your job. This is what you should be doing, you know, and then it's a thankless job, Benny, in many respects. So do I recommend it? Yes. Do I understand that coaches don't do that? Absolutely. And this is, again, not to toot our own horn or not to really plug our product all too much, even though this is what sponsors the episode and the podcast itself, but this is why we're developing the masterclass and been developing the masterclass and released the masterclass, is so that the parents can take on that role of mentoring the kid, so that the parents can sit down with the kid watching an international or professional game live or on TV or whatever and teach the kid these sorts of things.
Yeah. Actually, Gary, I don't know if we addressed it on the last podcast, but I think one of the guys that had emailed us, he was asking like, hey, should I recommend to all the parents on my team that they go and, you know, purchase the masterclass? Like, would that be beneficial for my team?
Yeah, I don't remember. I get so many emails, Benny. Do you remember what I said back to them? I probably said, no, don't do that unless like you yourself have gone through it and know what's in there. I don't even know what I said.
I can't remember what you said.
But in that scenario, I probably said, I would say, no, don't recommend it. If it was a coach, right? No, don't recommend it to your parents. Like, you actually have to know what's in there. You have to see the value associated with it. And then sure, tell your parents, hey, if you go here, you're going to be a smarter soccer parent and you're going to be able to mentor your kid a lot better. But I just don't remember the email, Ben. It vaguely rings a bell.
Right, for sure. Gary, what do you think? Like, obviously you were at most of Brian's training sessions, you know, irrespective of the attacking patterns. What do you think is the most effective finishing activity that maybe you saw Brian do, or maybe you've seen, you know, top level teams do?
I think the most important and practical one is the service from the outside and then the attackers crashing the box and trying to finish off the play. The central forwards or the weak side winger and the offensive mids recognizing those moments, crashing the box and then getting on the end in the air, on the ground, whatever flavor service from the outside, because that is something that happens so often in matches that the opportunities usually come from there. The opportunities usually don't come from lightning combination play up the middle and then somebody finishing up the middle. While a lot of breakaways do happen, maybe we're with a filtered ball and maybe the striker's left 1v1 with the keeper, or maybe the striker just has the dribble by one defender, you know, and then finish the play. Those are more rare than service from the outside. So that's my answer, man. Service from the outside, crash the box, get on the end of it, make good contact, okay? And emphasize, get your shot on target. Until you can consistently get your shot on target, don't try and train placing the ball bottom left, top right, or smashing the ball. The other important recommendation that I've always given, because I was usually charged with finishing. You know, Brian would work all the other stuff. I was usually charged with finishing. I think the most important recommendation is telling folks, don't try to blast it with all of your power. The best thing to do is, hey, focus on giving it 50% power. If you can smash the ball at, I don't know, 40 miles an hour, no. Hit the ball so that it goes 20 miles an hour, basically. So by doing that, you're able to control your body a lot better and make good contact better. And so you'll get it on target a lot better. And so once you master 50% power, okay, then elevate it to 60, then to 70, then to 80, then to 90. But dude, don't try to kill it. Just tap it in.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, Gary, because that slipped my mind when I was talking about a lot of the problems I see at the youth game. Like, I can't tell you how many times somebody will get into the box and clear opportunity to score, and they just launch it as hard as it can, and it's just completely random. You know, they'll score like 1 out of 10 on those opportunities. So I don't know, Gary, maybe it was you at one of our sessions, or maybe it was Brian, but I always remember, like, you guys taught us, like, dude, if you're past the PK spot, just like slot it to the corner inside of the foot, you're gonna score every single time like that, versus randomly smashing it as hard as you can and crossing your fingers to hope that it goes in. I think that's huge.
Yeah. And the expression that I would always give when I'm talking about placement, you know, trying to place the ball, which is then a next level sort of thing, is don't look at it as a shot on goal. Look at it as a pass on goal. So you're trying to make a pass to the post, basically. So pass it to that area on the, you know, close to the right post or close to the left post. It's a pass to your teammate, but your teammate is the goal. So what, are you going to blast it to your teammate as a pass? No, you're going to make sure that they can easily receive the ball. So just make a pass to the post.
Yeah. How about set pieces, Gary? How much time should a team spend on rehearsing those? And I think people, maybe they'll disagree, but, you know, I know you guys advocate for a lot is like the rehearsal of throw-ins. And, you know, think about how many times the ball goes out of bounds every single game. And most teams never rehearse throw-ins, so when they're doing it, it's just kind of like random chaos. Versus, like, if you can, especially when you're in the opponent's half or in, like, basically the final third, just a little bit of movement off the ball and a little bit of choreography, it can lead to a chance on goal, you know, every single time. So how much time should a coach spend on rehearsing set pieces, including throw-ins?
Yeah, set pieces is huge, dude. Let's see. It shouldn't take all that long. You know, offensive patterns is more difficult for players to really master, and it's more difficult. Same thing with building out of the back. Those are things that you have to do religiously forever, literally forever. And then, you know, set pieces, I think not so much, because everything is so strict. There is no creativity associated with it. That once you understand the rules, I go here, they do this, then I do that, and you just commit that, then you're done for the most part. Yes, you have to rehearse it over and over again for them to commit the rules to their brains, and then get used to the execution of it, of course. But it shouldn't take as long as building out of the back, attacking patterns, et cetera. How often should you do it? I mean, if you've never done it, get started right away. and you keep doing it. Maybe it's a 10-minute thing per session. I don't know, 15 minutes. Let's say 15-minute thing per session. Usually at the end of the session, maybe. So it's the last thing that you've done after you're exhausted. You know, this is something that doesn't take up a lot of energy from you. And especially before a match, you know, the last training session of the week, I think, is probably the most valuable to do set pieces in particular, set piece corners or set pieces outside of the box. Because, you know, 2 days from now, we're going to actually have a match. So it's fresh in their minds.
Right. I feel like,
in terms of finishing, because you wanted this episode to be more about finishing than anything else, in terms of finishing and getting that victory finally, even though you had 70% possession, you can't score a goal, this stuff comes in super handy, right? To actually score a goal, especially at the lowest of levels. And then, okay, cool. We weren't able to finish during the flow of the game, but we got the goal this way.
100%. Especially Gary on the girls' side. Like if you can rehearse an effective corner kick play, like I'm sorry to say this, but just girls are shocking at headers, dude. You know, so if you rehearsed, seriously though, dude, but if you can have your team organized and get into the right spots and just a simple delivery, I mean, you could score 8 out of 10 times, dude. That's the other problem, Gary. Obviously, I know the U.S. implemented this whole like no heading rule. I don't know how long ago, like 10 years ago. But it's funny, Gary, because when they get to the age where they can head, like you'll see like the first game, it's like, all right, now you're allowed to head. They'll serve a ball and like the kid is like ducking out of the way, you know, so we're just not used to it. So
I never even thought of that, Benny. This is the first time you've put that idea in my brain. I never even thought of it. So what, they can start heading it at age what, 12, 13? When is it?
I think you're right, 12 or 13. I'm not 100% sure. But once they get...
Yeah, total sense.
Yeah, once they get to like the second year of 9v9 is when they're allowed to just start heading the ball.
Sense that now they're scared. They're right, scared. Yeah. And by the way, even if they're not scared, they have no idea how to do it.
I mean, think about it. You told your whole life, like, you can't head the ball. And all of a sudden it's like, right, now you can head.
Yeah. I'm not a doctor. I don't claim to be a doctor and understand, you know, the validity of the science or nothing. It's just an interesting observation that I never thought of.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. My whole youth career, I was allowed to head the ball. Look at me now.
There's nothing wrong with you.
I'm a little bit slower. Maybe. I don't know. Gary, I guarantee you probably smashed 1,000 headers by the time you're 8 years old. Dude.
Oh, bro. Literally. So in our backyard where we grew up, there's a chain link fence separating. So our house, very modest house, like 1,400 square feet or 50, I don't remember what it was, but we had a nice backyard and there was a chain link fence in our backyard that separated us from our neighbor. And our neighbor was down a hill, okay? Like literally like 30 feet hill down to the neighbor. And the chain link fence was like 6 feet high, something like this, maybe 7. And you know, if Brian wasn't around, I would feed myself. But if Brian was around, he would like underhand a ball to me. Now we were like, I don't know, 6, 7, 8, 9 years of age, underhand it to me. And I'm running right towards where he's going to underhand it. He underhands it, and I do a diving header and like a power header, right? And the incentive here is don't hit it over the chain link fence because you don't lose your ball. But all of a sudden, it's like we had to sneak into the backyard somehow and retrieve it. So that was a really good training exercise to make sure it's on target. You keep it low, all that sort of stuff. But yeah, I was smashed thousands of balls, dude, when I was growing up.
Badass, dude. Badass. I don't know, Gary. Maybe the solution is to like, you know, first year of heading, bring some fucking like volleyballs to your training or something. Just let them get in the habit of you know, smashing balls with their head. Because I'm telling you, for that first year, they are like terrified to head the ball, dude. So. I don't know.
Interesting.
Let us know in the comments if you ever tried a volleyball heading session. Something, dude, you know?
Totally.
When they do that, it hurts or they start crying. It's shocking, dude.
Well, okay. So that brings up finishing with the head, too. That's very difficult to do.
Yep.
Very special strikers can do that.
How do you train a 9, Gary, to have that hunger? Like you mentioned earlier in the episode, like Holland. I look at Mbappe. I think the best knight of all time is Ronaldo, not CR7, Ronaldo number 9, the phenomenon. But when I watched him play, he just had that like desire to score, that hunger, always putting himself in the right places, diving headers. How do you train that in a young kid to have that hunger, to have that eye for goal? Or is it just something that you got to kind of naturally have it, dude? I don't know.
Yeah, man. Another million-dollar question. I don't know. And I can sit here and say, oh, we always, you know, try to talk to them and we did X, Y, and Z to make them hungry. And you don't know whether that's why they actually were hungry or they were just naturally hungry, if that makes sense. So, you know, Misa, right? Misael Becerra, he was the striker, the number 9 of Brian's famous team at that U11, U12, U13 age group. And he was like a natural born killer. You know, he was small in stature. He was not a man child, but he just had I don't give a fuck attitude. And I don't care who's in front of me. I'm going to screw you and I'm going to score. And that is all I cared about. He did not care about executing a good pass. He didn't care about anything. He cared about harming the opponent. He just had that in him. But he flamed out at the end of the day. So at the end of the day, you know, when he turned 16, 17 years of age and you're getting to that point where you might graduate to that next level, the professional level, girls came into the picture, freedom with a car came into the picture. And look, I'm not saying that I know definitively that this is the reason this particular player didn't make it, but those were my observations. And so how strong really was the desire and mentality and all that stuff to be a killer striker in soccer and keep doing it and stay motivated to doing it? Here's an example of a kid who was 9 years old, from 9 to maybe age of 14, maybe 15, I'd say, had what everybody would say, that's a killer, that's a goal scorer, you know? And then after that, nah, not so much. And it wasn't because of his physical prowess, as I just said. It's not because he was a man child, had nothing to do with it. And then the opposite is true, Ben. I've had situations. You've heard you know who Carlos Hernandez is from our old Rage team, from Brian's best work ever. He was a defensive midfielder, short in stature, Mexican-American.
Red card magnet, dude.
Yeah, so exceptional technique, understanding of football, everything. But he was like lazy in a lazy sort of slob way, you know, and not always motivated, you know, one of those sorts of players. So I was always tasked, and it would work, you know. I would always talk shit to him before, like, big games when we were going up against a very well-known team. Oh, you're going to get run over today, dude. Evan Rayner is, like, one of the best players in the country. He's on the youth national teams. He's going to eat you for lunch. You think you're actually good, Carlos? You're going to get so exposed tomorrow. You know, that I literally was saying all these sorts of things. And then tomorrow would come. And he was of the mentality and the hunger that you just described and asked me the question about. He would eat everybody alive. He was impossible to defeat. He was the best player on the field. And so it was in him. He could do these things, but it wasn't in him for the long haul. And as many times as I did what I could to fire him up, you would light the fire, but the fire would then just flame out and you'd have to light the fire again. And then you'd have to light the fire again. But some players just have the fire all the time. And I don't know why that is, Ben.
Yeah. You know, what's funny, Gary, is that Carlitos has a son, or I think he has like 4 kids now, but his oldest son was in the same age group that I was coaching against. And we played his team one time and, dude, the kid's like 7 years old. He's like exactly the same as Carlitos, like freaking boss on the field, like mean ass tackles. Like he just can't stop that ball, you know. So I think some players.
He's a good player.
Yeah, he's a great player, dude. Great player. I try to get him on my team. Like Carlitos, let's go, dude.
Good. Yeah, future pro or not like that level?
Too early to tell, dude. Too early to tell.
Okay.
Could be. Could no, be. You just can't
people
have.
People say, go ahead.
You just can't have the mentality of Carlitos, dude. He's got to. You know, just stay after it.
Correct. It just makes me so sad. There's so many players that we've seen over decades that absolutely had professional player capabilities and potential, but hands down, Ben, like it's not even close. Like they were literally better, far superior than the guys who ended up becoming professionals and having long-term careers. They were way better than those guys and they didn't make it. And guess what? It's this up here, man.
Yeah.
That is still the big mystery, Ben. You can't replace this, dude. And I don't know if you can actually train it.
Right. No, actually, when I was thinking about topics for today, the topic of, you know, the pathway to pro came up and, you know, what it takes to become a pro. So maybe in a future episode, we can touch on that. But I mean, Gary, you've seen countless players that could have been national team quality. And like you said, the mentality just wasn't there, and mentality is everything, man. So I wanted to ask you though, just to wrap it up about finishing, who's your best nine you've ever seen, like professional wise?
I would say the same one you said, Ronaldo, the real one. Okay. The Brazilian, not the Portuguese one. Okay. The overrated Portuguese one. The real one. Benny, you just don't understand. I don't want to say you don't understand, but I think you were too young, right? To really appreciate it.
His highlights, dude. I know you've seen like fucking full games of his and probably
I lived it, dude. I lived through his era. My first memories of him were World Cup 1994 when he was 17 years old, you know, and I was in the stadium. And, you know, this is the quote-unquote Brazilian phenom who made the Brazilian national team for World Cup 94 as a 17-year-old. And that was kind of like unheard of back then if you were a 17-year-old to be on the best team in the world. But the most impactful memories are when Argentina is playing against them, because obviously we're Argentinian-American. And every single time that he would touch the ball, even if it's in his own half, the Brazilian half, it's terrifying. It strikes terror into you, even if he's 50 yards from goal, because he turns and he starts galloping, and it's a horse. It's a stallion. You cannot stop this fucking thing. You can't stop it. And it's not just raw velocity and power. It's the skill that comes along with it. It's the decision. It's everything. I imagine that this is what people felt like when you're playing against Messi. When I've been watching Messi forever, I don't get that same feeling as I would get with Ronaldo, but maybe that's because Messi was always on my team, you know? And so from that perspective, it's kind of like, okay, Messi has it. Maybe something will happen, but you don't think like, oh my God, they're in so much trouble. Versus if it's Real Madrid or if it's Brazil or if it's Colombia, when Messi gets it, that fan base is probably like, oh, Jesus Christ, so over right now. You know what I mean? Yeah. So Ronaldo, dude, the real one, that's the best nine in my opinion.
Hey, dude, that's badass that you got to see him play live, dude.
So it's so terrifying, Benny.
Oh, I'm sure, dude.
I don't think there's a player in world football that makes you feel that way now.
True. I mean, some people will say like Mbappe has that kind of like that quality of driving at players and like a freaking horse, and you just kind of can't stop him, dude. When he's on, dude.
You're right. You're actually absolutely right. And I take it back. Many of the things that I just said. When we play France, Argentina plays France, I do get a little bit of that terror when Mbappe gets it and he's 1v1 and he starts galloping towards our box. It is terrifying, but I don't know if you can magnify that times 10, Benny, that's what the other guy was, Ronaldo. Yeah. Completely different level.
Right. For sure. Promotion relegation, Gary. How does it tie into attacking?
Sure. Okay. I think it's the same thing usually over and over again. In this episode, we also talked a little bit about nepotism for a moment there, you know, with certain people's sons being given opportunities on professional teams. And obviously that's happening at the youth level too. And it happens at the youth national team levels, and it happens at the national team level. That sort of favoritism starts falling by the wayside because clubs are incentivized across all levels, not just players, but coaches and staff and everybody, to find who are truly the best insofar as finishing is concerned, insofar as attacking is concerned, insofar as who are the best trainers for those things is concerned, and dishing out the money necessary for those things as much as possible, because you have to survive. And if you want to get promoted, you have to do a good job of that. And if you don't want to get relegated, you have to do a good job of that. So it's just maximization of everything, Ben. That's what Pro Rel brings to the table. You have no choice. If there's no promotion relegation, like an MLS, franchise can be like, do we really have to have a scouting department that dedicating itself to finding the best possible nine or winger or whatever? That, how much is that going to cost us to have that sort of scouting department? Oh, $3 million? Nah. Like, what does it matter? We're not going to get relegated anyway. Or nah, like, even if we were to win the MLS championship or MLS Cup, how is that going to translate into profit or business or anything? It really doesn't matter all that much. And the same with USL, the Division II here in this country. How motivated are the clubs, the businesses, to go out and search and improve their striking team as much as possible? Because at the end of the day, if we win the USL championship, we don't get promoted. And if we come in last place or close to last place, we ain't getting relegated. So we're not desperate. There's just a level of desperation that comes along with an open ecosystem, with promotion relegation. People are desperate to be successful because there's massive consequences otherwise.
Yeah. Now, really quick, Gary, I also wanted to get your thoughts. I had read earlier in the season about, like, obviously Galaxy won, right, the MLS Cup last year. And now they have, like, the least amount of general allocation money. Like, some of their best players are getting, like, a decrease in their wages, you know, so... Even when you do win, I mean, what incentive do you have to freaking win? Like, it's shocking, dude. When I read it, I was like, what the fuck?
Benny, it's even worse. So let's say that you win MLS, okay, a certain season. Way things work here, almost all of it is based off of perception and optics and politics, okay? So if you happen to win the MLS season, everybody in that front office and everybody's like, you take a sigh of relief and you're like, okay, next season, we don't really have to do shit. You know what I'm saying? We're fine. Cause we can always say, oh, we won it last year. Yeah. You can't expect us to win it every single year or be close to winning it every single year. If we take a year off, you know, and barely make the playoffs or don't make the playoffs, it's not the end of the world. It's okay. So you win the championship, all of a sudden the next season, there's no incentive whatsoever to be the best you can be. It's like, meh. And the players the same way.
Yeah, that's crazy, dude.
It is wild. So all of a sudden it's like, oh, you know what? You know what's suffering now? We haven't been playing our youth much, you know, and our academy players are having second thoughts about signing here because, look, for the championship run or whatever, we didn't play the youth or we didn't give homegrowns a chance or whatever. So since we won it last year, this year we'll just, like, give charity minutes to a whole bunch of homegrowns, you know, just for perception purposes or optic purposes or political purposes, because we don't need to win this year. We're fine. We won it last year.
Yeah.
Just the incentives are completely fucked out of whack, Benny, in this country. Yeah.
That's so funny, Gary, that, like, in Europe, like, the top players, whenever they're going to make a transfer or want to go to a new team, like, what do they consider? They consider, like, how good is this team? Am I going to win the league with them? When a player is transferring to MLS, it's like, is my family going to have a nice home? Do I like the city? Like, they could give two fucks about how good the team is, or they could be coming to the last place team and they don't care, dude. As long as they're in a good location, nice home, you know, that's crazy.
Totally. Literally, Messi came to, like, I think it's Miami. If they weren't not last the season before Messi came, they were close to last place or at the very bottom of the table. That didn't matter. It doesn't matter at all, Ben.
Oh, dude. He's right by the beach. Fucking nice little flight to Argentina. He's living the dream, dude.
Yeah. And on top of that, I mean, the fans here, the mainstream, because they're all indoctrinated by the media that's owned by MLS, they're like, oh, well, it's kind of a good thing that any team can win it any year because, you know, then Messi doesn't care where he lands because he can make such a big difference that, you know, Inter Miami was last year and they could be first this year. So he's not really looking at the place on the table because all the teams are basically the same anyway, which is it's hilarious to think, Ben, because you're basically saying that whoever the champion of MLS was a particular year, they weren't really the best. You know, it was just a random lottery, you know, and their number came up and that's who won, because the team down the street or the other team over there on the other side of the country is just as good as you. And on any given day, things could have gone the other way and the champion would not be, you know, your franchise. It could be the other franchise. You're literally watching roulette basically here in this country. Yeah. There is no David versus Goliath. There is no tactical richness, because across the world where there is a huge disparity between quote unquote the best team and the worst team in a league, what that ends up developing is tactical richness, because the worst team or one of the worst teams in the league can't go to Real Madrid and say, you know what, we're going to take it to them, we're going to dominate possession, and no, you know, you can't do that. So what does that force you to do? It forces you to develop tactics. It forces you to say, okay, you know what, this is how we are going to bunker. This is the particular player on Real Madrid, Valverde or whoever, who we want to eliminate from the game. You know, so they pick and choose how they're going to set themselves up. And then how might we be able to steal a goal, right, in certain ways so that maybe we can get a result. That sort of stuff develops players, and that sort of stuff develops coaches, and that sort of stuff develops clubs, and that sort of stuff actually gives excitement to the game, because you have a David and Goliath thing and you're like, ooh, interesting, I wonder how they're going to try to get points here. And if it's going well for the poor team and Real Madrid finds itself in the 80th minute and it's 0-0 or 1-1, Real Madrid, it creates a massive desperation on Real Madrid. It's like the World Cup final at that moment for the last 10 minutes. Like, we need to fucking score a goal. Oh my God, we can't draw this game. So there's massive excitement, Ben. And it vibrates in the week leading up to that match, and it vibrates for the week after that match. That is football. That is what develops passion. That is authentic. Not this fucking roulette spinning thing where one day this team wins, the next day that team loses, and it's just fucking random nonsense.
Yeah. Like, I was in London for 3 months when the year that Leicester won the Premier League, Leicester City.
Yes.
And it just like the buzz in the pubs and like people talking, it was unbelievable to witness it. It was badass.
I should also say, because this is important and it's good for an audiogram too, potentially, is that people need to understand here in this country, they don't get it. Okay. They don't understand that it's not all about the trophy at the end of the season. It's not. It's about being a part of something, a club. This country, the people here don't know what a club actually is. You know, that the example I just gave of that team against Real Madrid, maybe it was, who knows, Athletic Bilbao, or maybe it was Mallorca, or maybe it was Tenerife, or whatever the fuck it is. They know they're not winning the league at the end of the season. It doesn't matter. What matters is the community, the club, the feeling of can we bring down the crown, right? Can we bring down Real Madrid? You know, can we screw over Atletico Madrid, or can we screw over Barcelona and make them lose points so that somebody else, you know, gets the title? There's so many varieties and variations, dude. We don't have it in this country. Hopefully, USL is being sincere, and hopefully US soccer does not, which is controlled by MLS, U.S. soccer doesn't stand in the way or create stupid rules so that USL doesn't implement this, at least a fake promotion relegation, so that the Americans could get just a little tiny taste of the real thing, even though it's not the real thing.
Good stuff, brother. That's a good one.
All right. Cool, dude.
All right, brother. Good stuff.
Well, that's it for today, guys. Thank you for listening. A reminder for coaches. You can get both the free and premium coaching programs at 343coaching.com. Don't let anyone tell you your teams can't win by playing dominant possession-based football while also developing individual players to the highest levels. Nonsense. We've proved it at every single level, and so have hundreds of serious member coaches across the country. Now that we've moved on to the pro level, We're delivering everything we've learned in the program. Don't wait and continue delaying getting on a proven path. And parents, 343masterclass.com is where you want to go to get a working compass for navigating the American soccer landscape with your player. It's pretty bad out there, but let our experience guide you. Lastly, if you're coaching 7v7, we've got you covered there as well. Go to 7v7coaching.com. Until next time, cheers everyone, and keep building.